conservation of energy is going to take place. You're putting 100 watts of energy continuously in this thing, 100 joules per second. That's what 100 watts means. It's got to go somewhere. And if it can't come out that port number two coax cable, because you've now broken that cable, it's got to reflect back and come out of port number three. When you're at the 100 watt level with a circulator, there's two things you've got to worry about. Number one, does the dummy load have a high enough power? Yes. Number two, does the circulator have a high enough power? There are micro miniature circulators you can buy at any frequency you like, which are rated up to and including 1 watt. And beyond 1 watt, they saturate because they're so small. Correspondingly, a 100 watt rated circulator at, say, for instance, a VHF frequency, like 470 megacycles, it's a pretty big chunk of material. I'm going to guess it's something in the vicinity of 2 or 3 inches in diameter. So the higher power circulators have to be made out of a larger amount of magnetic material in order not to saturate. You got to worry about saturation of these things, John. KC2WGB, KQIW.
All right, Dick, understood. So if you had a 1 watt circulator and you were to run 3 watts, the energy coming in is more than the magnetic field can compensate for. Is that basically what's happening?
I'm going to make a simplification. You're right. I'm going to try to add something to this one, John. And that is, the energy you're putting in is lighting up a certain number of domains. Each of these domains have a precessing action going on. In other words, there are a whole bunch of micro-miniature tops that are precessing, and they're precessing at the frequency you're putting in. And so there's only a certain number of tops in there. There's a certain number of magnetic domains that can tolerate a certain amount of energy. And the amount of precession is a function of how much energy you put in. As you start putting in more and more energy, eventually your precession magnitude is how far the top is from dead center before it starts wiggling, if you know what I mean. So a top with no energy going into it is a perfect spinning top that's not doing any precessing on the table. As soon as you start putting energy into it, it starts tilting over a little bit from straight up and down. It can only tilt over so far, 90 degrees, so to speak, and you can't go beyond that point for that amount of material. And as you're building a circulator or isolator for a larger number of watts, you're putting a larger amount of material in there, so that now you're putting the same amount of energy per magnetic domain, but you're doing it for a larger number of domains, so they can tolerate a larger amount of energy. Does that picture make a little bit more sense, John? Pass it back to you, and then you pass it over to Wes. KC2WGB, KQIW.
KC2WGB, yes, it does, Dick. That's perfect. That's all understandable. So that saturation is what limits the amount of saturation available, is what limits your input power. That's how I see it now. So, all right, very good. I'll pass it over to Wes. Wes, pick it up.
Well, at first I understand that we're dealing with the ferromagnetic resonance. I remember there was a discussion once, and there was a split opinion between Eric and Glenn about ferromagnetic resonance. First this question, and then I have another.
Yes.
The second one is, are we dealing with canceling of phase? Because the speed is different. Port number 3 is getting the signals that are canceled in phase at this port. Address you.
Yeah, because the clockwise signal and the counterclockwise signal in a circulator propagate at a different velocity factor. The bottom line is that the signal into port 1, the clockwise and counterclockwise signal, end up in phase at the desired frequency at port number 2. And circulators typically have, I'm guessing, in the vicinity of 10 or 20% bandwidth to them. They don't just suddenly die as you go away from the design frequency. They just slowly lose isolation. They slowly lose directivity. A really good circulator of commercial value has 15 to 20 dB of isolation. A laboratory grade circulator circulator. I have used laboratory-grade circulators that have 45 decibels of isolation. In other words, you put a signal into port one, it comes out of port number two, 0.05 dB weaker. Put a signal into port number two, it comes out of port number one, the backwards direction, 45 dB weaker. They can be made that good with careful design practices. And by the way, when you do, let me drop. If your particular miniature circulator is rated for 1 watt, and you decide to put 10 watts into it, you're about to say what happens. You're going to see a number of crazy effects. Number one, the input standing wave ratio that used to be 1.1 suddenly starts climbing to a very high number. Because it's saturating, your input impedance is no longer 50 ohms. It's going to start reflecting the extra power it can't tolerate. Second of all, even though this is a thoroughly passive item, you look on a spectrum analyzer to what's going on when you saturate a circulator or you saturate a Yeag filter. You see a whole bunch of other frequencies generated. Because of the crazy saturation phenomena, which is this precessing of the magnetic domains, and once it starts saturating, the amount of power that gets into the magnetic domain because of input impedance rejection starts decreasing, and it starts fluttering back and forth. The bottom line is you will see a bunch of other frequencies generated in this passive device. You may be driving it at 2 gigahertz, but so the average Yeag filter works very nicely down to around 1.8 gigahertz. By the way, the signal level at which it saturates gets lower and lower as you go down to the cutoff frequency, which is around 1.8 gigs for most Yeags. When you're down at a low enough frequency or a high enough power to saturate a Yeag filter, you'll see a bunch of other frequencies being generated which are not necessarily harmonically related. Let me drop. You may be driving the thing at too much power at 2.2 gigahertz, and you'll see a 1.85 gigahertz signal in there that's very ratty looking. And you wonder, where in the world is that coming from? It's not coming out of any of the circuits that you're using on your signal generator. The Yeag filter is doing it. So you saturate a Yeag filter. Its input impedance is no longer defined. Its isolation is no longer defined. And the frequencies it's generating is no longer defined. And oh, by the way, it'll also run hot. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
What about ferromagnetic resonance?
What about ferromagnetic resonance? The precession phenomena that I'm describing that gives you frequency selectivity of performance, whether it be a circulator or a filter, that magnetic precession, is that ferromagnetic resonance? I don't know. I'm not quite sure what the word ferromagnetic resonance means. I've never used that word when I was dealing with these things, but maybe I'm naive and I was using them as a black box, if you know what I mean, Wes. Make believe I just asked you for a definition of magnetic resonance. What would you say, Wex? Interrex JN, K2RIW.
Magnetic resonance. The magnetic resonance is when the rotating RF magnetic field has the same direction as the frequency and precessing electrons in ferromagnetic material. But what puzzles me is that for one hand, we have maximum coupling of energy from the RF signal to the ferrite material. I believe that ferromagnetic resonance, if the direction of rotation of the frequency of RF signal is changed, then minimum coupling will happen. But we're talking about physical, mechanical resonance at frequency of gigahertz. Something about interaction.
Okay, the individual magnetic domains inside of a Yeag filter are at the atomic level. Are you telling me that you cannot move a precession phenomena at the atomic level at 8 gigahertz? Is that what you're saying? They're doing it all the time, Wes. Go ahead.
No, I don't say that. Absolutely not. I had one discussion with you with the temperature exchange, and you were right. No, I'm not saying that. And don't say it.
I'll tell you one other set of words here, John. If you actually took a Yig circulator apart, what would you see? You would see your input connectors are connected to a piece of strip line center conductor. The piece of strip line is a Y-shaped center conductor. In other words, the input connector is a ordinary width piece of strip line, meaning a 50 ohm impedance, going into a certain distance toward the center of the circulator. At the junction of the center of the circulator, you see these three pieces of strip line coming together in a Y shape, 120 degrees between the Ys, between these individual pieces of strip line. And sometimes there's actually a larger circular chunk of strip line in the center, which looks like it's wider than 50 ohms, if you know what I mean. The slab of magnetic material is really a kind of a hockey puck, a thin hockey puck. And there's one slab on top of the strip line center conductor and one slab on the bottom. So you got the circular hockey puck sitting above and below the piece of strip line. That in turn has a shielded structure for the upper and lower ground plane. It's a triplate strip line. Outside of that upper and lower ground plane material is the upper and lower magnet. And those two magnets are the upper and lower magnet. Again, they look like a hockey puck. These are a disc magnet, and those two magnetic fields are in the same direction. They're both north up, so to speak. And if you made them north down, then the input signal from port 1 would go to port 3 instead of port 2. You just reverse the whole process. Let me drop. So it's a very nice compact structure built in a strip line manner, and all of that magic takes place with those two hockey pucks of magnetic material inside of the upper and lower ground plane, which has got this biasing magnetic field on the outside. In the old days, you were told that you're not supposed to bring a screwdriver, a pair of pliers, or whatever too close to the outside of the device for fear that you would change its magnetic field, you would degauss it. Well, nowadays, with these fancy neodymium-like magnets, which have extremely high coercivity, it's a fancy way of saying that it is extremely difficult to demagnetize a piece of neodymium magnet. It's got such a strong magnetic field that cannot be changed, that they no longer have those warning labels on these things anymore. On top of that, the whole package sometimes has an additional shield on the outside of new metal. But as I said, in the old days, you were told never bring a piece of magnetic screwdriver, pliers, or whatever near the thing for fear that it would change its tuning. They no longer do that. They're now very rugged, very impervious devices. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I don't know if Wesley has any further questions, but I'm complete with the mailbag. We can go over to Paul and get another interesting space report, see what's happening. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I haven't heard any further reports this week. More than 202,000 people volunteering to go on a one-way trip to Mars. That to me is a mind-blower. To take very high-performance people at Duke University or places like that and have them volunteer to go to Mars forever, one way, and never come back. And the average temperature at Mars is numbers like minus 80 degrees centigrade. And it's on the coldest, on the hottest day at high noon on the equator of Mars, it comes up to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh, by the way, at that exact location, that night, it'll go down to minus 120. You talk to the people who have lived in an Arctic area where they're living with these kind of temperatures all the time. It is a rough way to live. And they're living with normal atmospheric pressure. Let me drop. If you have to live at that temperature, minus 80 degrees all the time, and you have no local air, so you now got to live, whenever you're outside of your shelter, you got to be in a spacesuit. And the spacesuit has to be extremely well insulated and extremely high pressure on all those joints so that it maintains your air pressure inside and it protects you from the minus 80 degrees outside. It takes a lot of power to do that. A lot of energy has to be poured into that suit in order to maintain that temperature. a lot of energy is going to continuously be poured into that human being to create his metabolism, to make it work right. And living in a spacesuit, as I've described to you guys before, ain't fair, ain't fun. I mean, to do it for a couple of days, maybe, as a new experience, yes. To live the rest of your life that way, and who's going to be repairing all of these suits for all of these people that have to go outside to mine all of this material, to find water, to find oxygen? You have to manufacture oxygen, you have to manufacture water, and by some means you've got to grow a garden to manufacture your food. Wow. I think it's getting close to the point of impossible. And so if you're not going to create the oxygen, water, and food locally, and if it's going to be shipped to you over a 300 million mile path, and those shipments have to arrive very frequently, otherwise you're going to run out of those consumables, and when you do, it's game over. I can see more failure mechanisms here than success mechanisms. I've already asked you that question, Paul. Would you volunteer? WS2N is going to give a space report number 142, I think it is. Go ahead, Paul. K2LIW. What's NASA doing today?
And I'm definitely not going, Dick.
Okay, I'll take your name off the list.
Fine. Sign me up if they open up a Burger King there. I mean, no ham and egg. I mean, you can't even have egg, because they're not going to bring up chickens with them. What a world. I don't think they're going anytime soon. Most of the people that might have a shot would be here. Involved with SpaceX. I mean, if anybody's going to do it, they could probably do it, but even that's extremely doubtful. If it could beat NASA with the SLS system, and they're looking at the midnight 2030s, wow. And that's now, you know, how things get delayed. We'll see, Dick. Space report for today, a couple of items. We talked about the Stripe missile launch from Hawaii a while back. You know, that never did take off. That's the one that's going to be launched on a regular launch type of guided rail type of gadget. No rocket has ever made it to orbit on one of them. It's been delayed because they have problems with the first stage of this rocket from Hawaii. It would be the first time they actually get it to orbit from that launch facility in that state. They use that naval missile ground for a lot of other launches. They've launched plenty of rockets into space, like, you know, blew up another missile. The military uses it to test their different missile anti-ballistic equipment, but now they're going to also use it for space travel. This particular one could get, if operational, will be able to do up to 600 pounds to roughly a 250 mile orbit, and they would be able to do a lot of CubeSats. A lot of people want to send small satellites up, and hopefully that gets going, but that won't get flight until maybe October. They have to coordinate with the military and all, so they're looking at an October flight. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But it's on our rail launcher. They could do away with expensive guidance equipment on board the rocket. They could put this thing at an angle and blast off that way instead of going straight up and then doing a roll, changing its angle with their
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Time out the repeater, man.
We'll talk about it in October. This is WS2N space report. Another thing that NASA would like to do, probably in the 2020s, is go out and capture a boulder from outer space, out in the asteroid belt, and bring it back. They want to bring it back and put it into lunar orbit. There it would stay until an Orion spacecraft with two astronauts on board would go out and climb on board this asteroid and cut a piece out, throw it in a big suitcase and bring it home. So they had a plan A and a plan B. Plan B is now the one that has been accepted. Plan A, you know, we go out and actually grab a hold of a big flying asteroid and somehow nudge it back to lunar orbit with this balloon-type contraption that would surround it. Then they would fire it at the engines. This would all be done automatically without astronauts. And then it would go into lunar orbit, and then you would send astronauts on an Orion spacecraft to work on it. Plan B has been accepted, which I think is the better one. Go out, go to an asteroid, go down and find a boulder sitting on top of that asteroid. There's plenty of boulders on top of the asteroids. They know that now from all the reconnaissance we've done. And this robotic spacecraft would go down with three robotic arms, and they look like truss sections, three individual truss sections. They would go down and grab this boulder off the asteroid, and then fly away from it, and then use its rockets to again put this into a lunar orbit. And I'm talking about a big boulder. You know, this thing was huge from the pictures I saw. And again, astronauts would go up and attach themselves to it. You know, they'd have a docking collar on this robotic spacecraft, dock to it, get out of the Orion spacecraft, take some material off the asteroid, put it back in, and then fly back to Earth.
I have a question.
That's up to Dick. Dick, you have it.
Let's find out who the question is and go right ahead with your question, sir. Give us your call letters and name, and then your question.
Yeah, this is K1MGM, mic number 2. Just wondering why they would pick a lunar orbit and not an Earth orbit.
That's a good one. You've got it, Paul.
Well, I think, the amount of energy required to put this thing into a lunar orbit less than what they might need to go into Earth orbit. Another thing is, I don't think the public would want this flying asteroid sitting above their heads. I'm not a big fan of this whole thing, by the way. I always think some lunatic country is eventually going to develop the technology, and they might be bent on taking themselves and everybody with them and start developing ways to move these asteroids. And I know it's a good idea to be able to move one away from the Earth if one is coming here. And that's part of the goal of this whole experiment, not just to bring material back. But, somebody's bent on mass destruction and that had this capability in the far future is... I'm not too crazy about that. I mean, I think the chance of something like that happening is probably greater than one of these asteroids actually coming by and taking out the Earth. Who's to say? I don't know. I'd like to see more money spent on maybe heading to Mars or colonizing the moon or something. Does that answer the question? Back to you, Mike.
Yeah, let me add a couple of words to this one, see if we can draw a mental picture of this one. I'm going to drop for a beep. One way of picturing what a gravity well looks like is to start off with a very large sheet of rubbery material and then grab a little piece of it and pull down and create a cone-shaped hole, if you know what I mean. And if you did that for our solar system, have a great big hole in the center where the sun is. There's a great big gravity well where the sun is. Our planets go around on the edge of that gravity well on the sloping sides. That's where our planet goes around. But our planet itself creates another gravity well for the Earth. And the moon is in a gravity well around the Earth, And the moon creates a little bit of a gravity well. Okay. When you're coming from, let's do it in the forward direction first. It'll make a little more sense. You and I have blasted off our rocket, and we're going to go to Pluto with something called the New Horizons. And you use enough rocket power to achieve escape velocity from the Earth, more than 7 miles per second, and you've escaped Earth's gravity, so to speak. But as soon as you're any reasonable distance away from Earth, you think you're now just flying away from the Earth. As soon as you're any reasonable distance away from Earth, the thing that dominates is the Sun. Every single spacecraft that is really in between the planets is really an object that's in orbit around the Sun. It's in the gravity, it's in the partial gravity well of the Sun. Let me drop. So you're climbing up this uphill slope of a cone, where the biggest portion of the cone is created by the Sun, and its little minor cones in the sides of that cone, which are the individual planets. Now when you play things backwards, if I'm bringing an object from the Pluto area, and I just aim it very roughly toward the Earth, so to speak, if I'm not very precise at it, the thing it's going to see most is that great big gravity field from the Sun that's going to go toward the Sun. You and I are going to carefully steer it so that it goes roughly toward the Earth. And so it would experience a pretty high velocity as it starts coming near the Earth. And you now want to put it into Earth orbit. You've got to do a whole lot of braking because it's picked up a real big velocity as it starts getting close to the Earth. But if you've done a more precise aiming job and you aim it toward the Moon, you have to do quite a bit less rocket power braking in order to get it into lunar orbit. So that's what I think you're sort of saying, Paul. The energy required to come from a long distance back into lunar orbit is a hell of a lot less rocket power than required to get it into Earth orbit. Because if you don't have the amount of rocket power when it comes near the Earth, it's going to be accelerating real fast as it gets near the Earth, and it's going to go whizzing out the other side. You're going to need a lot of rocket power to slow it down to get it into Earth orbit. Is that approximately the way you see it, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Your words are very good. I could draw pictures maybe of the what I was trying to say, and gravity wells and all, but very well put, Dick. Good explanation. I agree. Yeah. The last thing they need is another SLS launch to do something like that. Space launch system. As it is, they're going to be launching one, and that will be for two astronauts to go out to the lunar orbit and do this. Now, they're not going to land on the moon or anything with this. They're going to go out. Their goal is to do what we just talked about, retrieve a piece of an asteroid. So we'll see how this goes down with the the budgets. Having problems right now with budgets. They'd like to cut off our opportunity that one of the rovers driving around on Mars. I think would be a big mistake. It costs you probably $500 million to get these things to that planet. And meanwhile, we have it sitting there, and it's staying by, ready to do more science. So after 11 years, they're thinking about cutting that, and they're going to think about cutting the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, the LRO. That's been up in orbit since 2009. They want to cut that. It's doing good polar orbit research. Polar orbit. Let me drop it. So, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's a long ways off, but that's definitely a plan. They're funding this particular mission. They've been tossing the idea around of Plan A and Plan B. Now they went with Plan B. So we'll see what happens. I just wanted to bring up talking about extended missions. On Friday, they launched three people to the International Space Station, two of which are going to stay there for a one-year period. The other one's going to stay there for a half a year. And that would be Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko of Russia, and another guy from Roscosmos is the other Russian, Podlako. Now this guy has been he's been commander of different space stations, I think, four different times. First one, he was commander for Mir. So he's got like 700 days under his belt, maybe, you know, not total. Three guys are really going to, add up more days. He'll add up 6 months. Kornienko and Kelly, they'll be up there for a year to see physically what happens to these guys. Scott Kelly's a twin. His brother is an astronaut as well, Mark Kelly. We're going to poke around with both guys, one guy here on Earth in Houston, and the other guy on the International Space Station. And they're going to see the differences, what occurs over this one-year period of time. Of course, Kelly says he's not too far from a vertical place in, Mark down in Houston. So, I mean, they're not going to go exact. But they'll try to keep an eye on both of them and see if there's any real differences. Especially with the eyes, they tend to have vision problems, and to an extent, permanent vision problems, and they can't have that on a trip to Mars. Never mind the osteoporosis that could occur, and which does occur, and a lot of the other physical problems. So at least they're talking about it, and this won't be the last one-year mission. There'll be, one right after the other after Kelly comes back next March.
Yeah, Paul, I think Scott and Mark Kelly are identical twins, and that makes them a very good test. One's going to be in space, and the other one's going to be sitting on the ground, and you can easily compare what happens as they age. You mentioned that eyes deteriorate in space. Give me a couple of words as to what happens to vision when you're in the microgravity for a long period of time. And is it the microgravity? Is it the extra radiation? Any idea what it is that changes in the vision? WS2N, K2RIW.
Good question. They're looking into it, and the pressure, tends to, all your blood pressure, and the blood in your body and fluids push up to your head. That's why everybody kind of looks puffy in the face. Apparently, they believe that's also happening with the fluid in your eyes, and it's changing your shape and vision. And if you go to Mars, they plan on having glasses where you can pull out the lenses, and change lenses as you go. There was a question in there, I think.
Yeah, who was the question? Give us your code, letters, and name, and then proceed with your question, sir.
Hey, Roger that. Name here is Joe in the Mobile, KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Quick question. I don't know if it's true or not. They're saying commercial airplanes are gonna in the future. They're gonna like fly up in space, up to the space station. Am I hearing that right? I heard this like a couple of weeks ago.
I'm gonna guess that that's somebody's proposal, Joe. But to get an air-breathing vehicle to a high enough velocity that you can then get it into space, which is 17,500 miles an hour, not a chance. I doubt it. I think various people have, on paper, designed such vehicles. And so, you can accomplish some of the liftoff distance off the Earth by an air-breathing vehicle with wings. But I think 95% of the real thrust to get you up to 17,000 miles an hour, I think it's got to come from a rocket. Let's see what Paul's got to say on that one. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
There's only two versions planned for doing that. And one is by Lynx. It's called Lynx. And that's by a company called X-Core. And they operate out of California. I think they're going to rent space now at Space America in New Mexico. And by the end of the year, they should be testing their Lynx rocket.
there. This is the Mach 2 version. It had a Mach 1. And, this would be... Oh, they had a prototype before. This would be Mach 1. And then they'll have a Mach 2 and Mach 3. This one will be able to fly, 60 miles up, 100 kilometers up, and then come back and land. It's going to take off like an airplane, like you said, and go up to altitude, experience weightlessness, see the curvature of the Earth, and come back and land. And you'll have one pilot, and you'll sit next to him. And you're going to lay out $100,000, but you'll get to get, qualified for space. That's one for dropping. The version 2 model will be able to take satellites up without people, bring up satellites to, the same altitude. They'll have a cargo bay open up, the satellite will come out, and it'll have a rocket stage on it, and that will put it into orbit. So that would be the Lynx Mach 2. Lynx Mach 3 version, which is on the drawing boards, would be eventually an orbital space plane. And again, you'd be able to take somebody up in that. So that's the American private corporation possibility. You've got Virgin Mobile, I think of the telephones. You got Virgin Galactic, and they're planning on doing similar suborbital flights, but they're kind of like on hold right now because they had a crash and one of their pilots unfortunately got killed. European model, they have a bigger plan than this. Let me drop it. Maybe that's the one you're thinking about. It's called Skylon. And the thing's been under development for quite a few years. It's built on a Sabre rocket, and this rocket will be air-breathing. We'll have hydrogen fuel on board, and it will get up to Mach 5, a little over Mach 5. And then after that, you're high enough, fast enough, it'll switch over to... liquid oxygen tank on board. Eventually, their plans are to have crew on this thing and supplies to be able to go up to space stations. By the time it's ready, there might be a year or two left on our space station unless they get an extended mission in 2024. But by then, other space stations. You have one by Bigelow planned called Alpha. Possible now. They're talking. I don't know how the funding is going to work out, but the Russians are actually talking with NASA about, ISS-2, another possibility. So with that and China coming on with a possible space station in the future, possibilities are endless for all these different companies involved with cargo flights. Dick, back to you. K2RIW, WS2N.
Roger that. How much will it take a cost for the regular Mojo? How much will it take a cost to go on one of those space airplanes? I was just wondering.
On the Lynx, about 90,000 right now, but that would be up by the time they get to launch. 90,000, and then Virgin Galactic, I think that's 200,000. No big deal. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's chump change. To me, that's real money. Paul, the current International Space Station is walking that very narrow line where they'd like it to be high enough up that it experiences very little atmospheric drag, but it's got to be low enough that it doesn't start touching the bottom of the Van Allen belt and bathing those poor astronauts with a whole lot of excess radiation. So they're walking a very narrow line. As such, I am guessing the International Space Station has to receive a boost 2 or 3 times per year in order to maintain the current altitude. Is that approximately right? It gets 2 or 3 boosts per year
on each of these cargo ships after they come up with their cargo. Whatever is left over with their boosting power, they do a little bit of boosting to the International Space Station. I have the impression that the onboard orientation rockets, in a worst-case situation, can do some boosting. But I think that's an expensive use of a consumable when you do that, and you don't want to do very much of that. I'm guessing that the majority of the boosting takes place by way of the visitations of cargo ships. Give me some words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
The main module for boosting the space station is in the as the module. That's the one where the Russian module where they live, they sleep. That's their control module. Just like we use Destiny, that's our module that, for the United States that we use for controlling everything, routing the electrical power and so on. But the Russians have the Zvezda, and that has its own rockets, its own fuel tanks. And what happens is you'll have a, let's say, a progress launch. They'll bring up cargo. Russians will dock, and whatever fuel is left in the progress, they'll use to boost the space station. They'll be docked to the rear of a Zvezda. So they use fuel to push the space station with its own rockets. Then they have fuel line connections, which recharges the tanks and Zvezda. Sometimes you have a progress come up with a little less cargo, but a lot more fuel loaded up with the fuel. The progress is the same size as the spacecraft. When it comes up alone, without people, that whole front piece, which normally separates before it burns up before landing, is now loaded up with fuel tanks. So they load, utilize that to as a floating gas tank to charge up Zvezda. That's basically...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Automatic transfer vehicle, which the last one just left, the fifth one, they're not building anymore. They were very large spacecraft. Before 2011, this whole process was in effect. They had a space shuttle, used to do quite a bit of boosting as well. So they still do it, and they have to do it all the time. Otherwise, their orbit would decay. They stay around 200, let's call it 250, but it's probably around 248, I think, is the average number. So it oscillates, they'll drop down 10 miles. They'll go back up 10, 12 miles on the on a reboost. So pretty much it. You've got the Japanese H-2 vehicle. That's a cargo vehicle, and that was Auckland Space Station. But that's not really a main fueling there. It's just a cargo version, just like Cygnus or Dragon. So they don't do any reboosts. So that's pretty much it, Dick. Right now you got the progress vehicle really doing all the work. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you to make a guess. Does progress give a boost to the space station and or give it fuel so it can do its own boosting? But I'm guessing the boosting is approximately 3 times per year. On top of that, the cargo itself, I'm guessing a significant amount of that cargo is oxygen, food, and water. Now, in the case of water, it is possible to recycle the fluids that come out of a human being and get potable water out of that. So a significant percentage of water is probably recycled. I believe no food is recycled. You have to bring them food. And I think you've got to bring them oxygen. I think no oxygen is recycled. I'm asking you for a confirmation on this, Paul. Your lithium hydroxide filters, the human beings are breathing in oxygen, breathing out carbon dioxide, and the lithium hydroxide filters, I think, are filtering the carbon dioxide out of the breathable air, and that remains in the filter, and I don't think there's any way of recovering that oxygen. I think those filters become waste that is sent by the cargo ships back down, is my guess. So you've got to continuously be bringing them oxygen and food and a small amount of water that's not recycled. Some of that's my guess is, Paul. How close am I? And I'm guessing 3 or 4 boosts per year. WS2N, K2RIW.
They do need a lot of water up there. They bring plenty of it, and not only to drink, but to breathe. They separate that. But just to backtrack a little bit, they now have a lot more fuel left on the Progress ship because, 3 or 4 years ago, every time either of the Soyuz, by the way, Soyuz will do the same type of thing too. They'll bring up cargo, and remember, it's not just people, they'll bring up water and everything. So that's a supply ship as well. Progress now has a lot more fuel than they used to three or four years ago. They used to take, take a little over 2 days. They'd orbit, maneuver, eventually getting to the space station. Now the Russians have gotten so good at it, and SpaceX is doing, pretty much doing the same thing, that they'll be, that they now have a 6-hour flight. That's it. 4 orbits around the Earth, and they dock with the space station, which means there's more fuel left over to play with. By the way, most people know that after the cargo vessel is finished, that thing deorbits and burns up in the Pacific. The Soyuz craft has to have enough fuel, of course, on board to maneuver and get three people back every time it comes back. They got this all figured out pretty good. As far as oxygen, one of the ways they get oxygen outside of actually bringing it up, and they do load up, for instance.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
West lab, big nitrogen tanks and oxygen tanks. They need both. And they, anytime they get a chance, they resupply those tanks. There's probably 6 very large tanks. Each one about 3 or 4 feet diameter. So the water that comes up, they have electrolysis, basically. Naturally, the power is being supplied by these humongous solar cells, solar panels, 240 feet long. Got 8 of them supplying plenty of power to the space station. So, they don't have so much left over that even when the shuttle used to come up, they had jumper type of wires hooked up to supply the space shuttle with power. And then the space shuttle didn't need to use its solar cells. Fuel cells. Fuel cells. They saved on the fuel cells on the space shuttle, and they were able to have even longer extended missions. So there's plenty of power, and they take this power and use it for electrolysis. Separate the water, get oxygen to breathe, and hydrogen, the space station's been up, 1998 was the first launch. So they dumped the hydrogen overboard for now. Now, the last couple of years, they've been taking a lot of the hydrogen, and they've been feeding it into the Saboteur machine, I think they call it. Somebody's name that invented this thing. I can't pronounce it right. But it begins with an F, and this machine is located in the Tranquility module. It's one of the nodes, one of the big modules up on the space station. And in there, they have like a bathroom, and they look sensor facilities. That's where the cupola is hooked up, where they blow it up, and they can look at this panoramic view of the huge windows. In that module is this saboteur machine, which takes the hydrogen and, well, they dump the, they mix it with carbon dioxide or something, and they, I'll have to look up the chemical exchange, and they wind up recycling that and getting more breathable air. Trying to think out of my head, but they're able to save that wasted hydrogen and utilize that. Trying to remember the, I'm missing something. I'll have to look it up. I'll get back to you next week on that, Dick. But there's a process that's going on. They plan on using that on Mars when they get there, too. And two other quick topics I wanted to cover, Dick, before we go. Back to you.
So by way of the human beings exhausting from their breath carbon dioxide, which in the old days used to be filtered out of the air with lithium hydroxide filters. They're the equivalent of activated charcoal filters, so to speak, which, what was that again, Paul?
I remember what I wanted to say. They create, with the saboteur machine, they're mixing the hydrogen, and I think it's the oxygen, but this process is creating water, so they're actually getting water back. So, That's what it's doing. Back
to you. So my main question is that human beings need a continuous supply, a significant supply of oxygen in order to do the metabolism, in order to stay alive. Is any of the oxygen human beings on a space station are breathing, is any of it recycled, or does all of it have to be brought up in fresh oxygen cylinders? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
No, a lot of it is separating with this electrolysis process. You know, they're taking water, they're separating the hydrogen and the oxygen. And then, that's why the water is so important. So now they can breathe the oxygen, they can take the hydrogen, and they mix that with something else. This is kind of carbon dioxide or something, and then they wind up with water again out of that. But what's left over, I think is it methane? Whatever's left over, they have to dump over it. They have to dump it. I think it's methane, and they have to dump it. And that's why they want to utilize this process on Mars, because then you could take the water, whatever water you got, separate it. Now you get oxygen. Take the hydrogen, mix it with, I think, carbon dioxide, and you're going to wind up with water and byproduct of methane. Then you take the methane and be able to use it for fuel. Something along those lines. And they can't survive with six astronauts on board. It's not enough water and it's not enough oxygen. But it supplements it quite a bit. And they don't, whatever they have, they don't have to bring that much more up with them. But all these flights that come up will bring extra oxygen and nitrogen too. You need nitrogen to supply the space station.
The methane that's made with that fancy machine in the cupola, is that to be used as a fuel right now? I know in the future they're thinking of using that as a fuel. And I think you're saying that that machine recycles the carbon dioxide coming out of the human beings, and you get methane and oxygen out of that machine, and then that oxygen can be reused. So I presume that that lowers the amount of oxygen you have to bring up on each cargo ship. Also, when it comes to a Soyuz coming up with three astronauts, I'm going to guess those three astronauts are almost the 100% payload, that there's not a heck of a lot of extra cargo. If you're bringing up with a Soyuz one or two astronauts, I think you can bring cargo. But if there's three astronauts, I'm not convinced there's much room left over for cargo on the Soyuz, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I know. They stuffed them in there. But now you can bring up
on a progress ship, probably, you know, 5,000, 6,000 pounds worth of stuff. People weigh a couple hundred pounds, but then, you know, the spacecraft itself is really designed. There's a lot more weight involved. It's just to keep the three people alive for days on end in case they don't make it to the space station in time, which happened once. You've got solar cells supplying the power for the for both Progress and for Soyuz. There's always bags and bags of water if you ever see what they unload from the Progress or the Soyuz. So there's weight in there. Not nearly as much as what you're going to bring from a Progress ship. Because they're both launching on the same rocket, the same Soyuz rocket. But yeah, there's two basic machines that we're talking about on the space station. One, electrolysis machines, they call it. It's even spelled funny. It looks like electron. It's got a Z in there. I don't know what it is. But it's basically an electrolysis process. So they're separating the water. They're getting the oxygen and the hydrogen. And then it goes into the Saputo machine in the Tranquility node. And that's taking the hydrogen and it's mixing it with carbon dioxide. Because when you exhale, you have carbon dioxide. Mix the carbon dioxide with the hydrogen, and you're going to wind up with water and methane as a byproduct. And no, they're not using the methane for anything. They're dumping that overboard.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Side of the tanks that are all over the space station, especially around that Quest lab. The backup machines are these things that they light off. You have to ignite them. And the byproduct of it is this solid burning fuel, whatever it is oxygen. And they call them candles. And this is one of the ones that went on fire on Mir. They had a fire from this thing. But they're not the primary source. They're backup units on the space station. That's about it, Dick. Back to you.
I'm getting the impression, Paul, from what you're telling me, that the most compact way of bringing up oxygen, as long as you've got the solar power on board with the solar cells, so you can do electrolysis, to bring up water H2O, I think the atomic number for water is 8, and I think that's also its atomic mass. Yeah. So eight units is oxygen, 2 units is hydrogen, so it's up to 10. So I guess 80% of water is oxygen. And the nice thing about the water that's inside of, the oxygen that's inside of water, is you don't have to pressurize it. I mean, to bring up liquid oxygen, you got huge problems of high pressure tanks and cryogenics. So bringing up oxygen is a pain. Bringing up water is easy. And then by electrolysis, you get the oxygen back out. So that's the most easy way of conveying oxygen, is what I think you're telling me. I'm guessing they bring up a few emergency cylinders of oxygen. So, but the majority of the oxygen, you're bringing it up in the form of water that's about to be electrolyzed by the electrical power on board. And then also the carbon dioxide, a certain amount of the oxygen from there is also recovered. So I guess the amount of oxygen that the astronaut is breathing, you could probably estimate what percentage of it is fresh stuff being brought up with the cargo ship and what percentage of it is recycled oxygen. Over to you, Paul, K2RAW.
Yeah, I don't know what the percentage is. I know that it's not zero. They would love to see zero, but it's not. It's not another biosphere, unfortunately. That's why these other flights they do have to, they're always constantly bringing stuff up. And water, yeah, is the main thing. These tanks, these electrolysis machines, they showed the three astronauts standing behind each one of them. Each one was almost as tall as they were, so they were pretty large machines. Number Three of them. I just want to mention, we talked about the SMAP,